Then we are actually ready to start. And the two persons who are here to welcome you and introduce you to the conference is Kristen Krogh, rector at OsloMet, and Jannicke Wiis-Jensen, research leader at NIFU. So please welcome Kristen Krogh firstly.
Hello and welcome. My name is Kristen Krogh. I'm a rector here at the Oslo Metropolitan University. They do say that my accent is a fair combination of Scottish and Norwegian. I studied in Scotland before I went back to Norway to study there. I do have some experience with international mobility. During Easter vacation, I went to Barcelona to visit my oldest daughter, which is an exchange student there. I've experienced firsthand what it means to be, you know, in the vicinity around students being subject to student mobility. I would, however, like to welcome you all to the Oslo Metropolitan University, OsloMet, as we say for short. At the Oslo Metropolitan University, our aim is threefold, as most universities. The first aim is to educate people, to send students out into society with competence and knowledge about the workings of the welfare states, and to ensure that we have a society that has the competence that the society needs. The second is to develop knowledge, you know, which concerns the areas that you educate students in. Or to put it in a more fashionable way, we develop knowledge for those places where the welfare state meets the societal challenges. And the third is to ensure that what we do in terms of education and research has a purpose in society. They do say that universities are mostly concerned with what they are good at, but we are also concerned with what we are good for. Therefore, it is a pleasure to welcome you all to this conference on international student mobility, which is held here at our university. We shall discuss, or mostly you, I hope, how international students' mobility are at the crossroad, what affects students' flow to and from Norway, and what benefits students gain from studying abroad. As we do know, the world is facing a number of challenges these days. We have the climate crisis. Now, why should we travel at all when we have to concern sustainability? But then again, we have a geopolitical situation which merits that more communication is better across borders and across cultures. Therefore, it is so important that we ask our students to travel abroad to experience what they can from other cultures and other educational societies. So today, there will be a discussion of all these implications, these factors for students' flows to and from Norway, and our educational institutions and how society in Norway handles that as such. I have noticed that the conference program includes a variety of expert speakers. There will be discussions and ample time for meeting each other during the breaks. And the effect of such conferences and seminars is, of course, also that knowledge and competence wanders between the persons that participate. I do see a fair amount of our own colleagues here, but also colleagues from other universities and research institutes across Norway. So I do think that this is a great opportunity to gather new knowledge and new insights. So, as you and we embark upon this journey of exploration and critical reflection, let us keep an open mind, and let us hope that we will share new and valuable insights, and that this will be well-spent hours today to hear both our external invited speakers and each other comment upon this important endeavor of international mobility. So once again, I would like to welcome you all to the Oslo Metropolitan University. And without much further ado, I would like to introduce Jannicke Wiis-Jensen to commence upon welcoming you from her perspective and from NIFU. Thank you.
My name is Jannicke Wiis-Jensen, and I am have been a project leader of a research project that we will present some results from And now I will just briefly take you through what we are going to do today. This is the aim of this conference is threefold. We would like to present results from a project called the International Student Mobility Drivers, Patterns and Impacts, or Mobility in short. We would like to take the opportunity to invite some international scholars to share their perspectives on emerging issues in international student mobility. And we would like to engage discussions and reflection on the future of international student mobility. The project, the mobility project, is coming to an end this year. It has been a project addressing international student mobility to and from Norway mostly. But of course, we put this into a context. It is a cooperation between NIFU, OsloMet and Uppsala Universitet, and it is funded by the Norwegian Research Council. We have several work packages in this project. We have one addressing the student perspectives, looking at recruitment to international student mobility, students' assessments of being abroad, etc. And we have one project addressing the policy context, to looking at the development of Norwegian policy in this area. We also have a work package addressing labor market outcomes. So we look at what happens after graduation when students have finished their education and enter the labor market, asking, does it make a difference whether you have education from abroad or not? And then we have also a work package addressing teacher education more specifically. We wanted to go in more in detail into one field, and we decided for teacher education because it's an important education in Norway that traditionally have had sort of limited international student mobility. So this is also addressed, and there's a one of we have a PhD student who have written her thesis on this topic. So, just to briefly introduce the core team of this project, we have this is sort of our main researchers. We've had associated researchers and also an international advisory board involved as well. So here you see that's Mari Elken, Elisabeth Hovdaugen, Håvard Helland, Agnete Vabø, and our PhD students, Thea Dyrød Pedersen and Olga Seredjak. And I've been the project manager. So there's also a project webpage where you can find more information about the project and also more details. The publications are listed there because what we will present today are highlights or some snapshots. So what we will hear today is that we will have a presentation from Hans de Witt, and who will talk about a more historical perspective and also some emerging issues in international student mobility. We will have also presentations from Mikael Børjesson and André Bryntesson. They will tell us about the introduction of tuition fees in Sweden, what happened there, which is interesting information these days when tuition fees are going to be introduced in Norway. We will also have a debate about this topic. And then we will have presentations from the project, and also we have Tilde Juhl-Wiese from Aarhus University, who will give a presentation together with one of our researchers. I hope you will all enjoy this day and find it useful. And, you know, one of the things that has been important during the last few years regarding international student mobility, that this COVID made such a difference. It sort of put an end to certain activities and some things stopped in a way. And COVID is still around. So unfortunately, our speaker, Hans de Witt, tested positive for COVID this morning. So he will give his speak from his hotel room here in Oslo. So, well, that's the way it is. He made it all the way to Oslo and then this happened. Yes. So then we just have to find him online. Hey, you know how to, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, so as Jannicke reminded us, COVID is not quite over yet. Our first speaker today is Hans De Witt, and I really hope you can hear us.
Yes, I can hear. Thank you.
Oh, that's great. He's an emeritus professor of the practice and distinguished fellow at the Center for International Higher Education at Boston College. Hans De Witt has a long experience of studying the internationalization of higher education. His current research interests include how to reach global learning for all students, the future of internationalization after the COVID-19 pandemic, international student recruitment, as well as mobility in non-Anglophone countries. And De Witt is here with us today in order to give some critical reflections on international student mobility in a time of global challenges. So please, Hans De Witt.
Thank you very much, and apologies again that I will not be able to be with you in person. This is quite ironic. I have been indeed doing quite some research and presenting and reviewing and write books and chapters and webinars on post-COVID internationalization of higher education. Then it's quite ironic that just to yesterday evening, my wife found out that I was that she had COVID, and then she asked me to test this morning, and I did that, and unfortunately, I have COVID as well. Not serious symptoms, so I feel fine, but I don't want to risk you all by being in person there. Also, that's very sad because I really looked forward to having the possibility to be in person interactions with you after having had so many webinars with personal contact. So sorry about that. Okay, let's go then to the next slide immediately, so not to waste time. As has been said, I'm doing some critical reflections about international student mobility, but I want to put it into the broader context of the concept of internationalization in and of higher education, because international student mobility is not isolated from what is broader in the context of internationalization. So in the first part, I will address what have been and are the main trends, rationales and drivers for internationalization over the past decades. What are the different perceptions and meanings of internationalization, and what are key shifting paradigms, and then what might be the future directions of internationalization in response to current drastically changing global context. And in the second part, I will be more specific on the international student mobility aspect. So what do we mean with international student mobility and its different types? What are the key trends in those different types? And what, at the end, I will put some questions for discussion about key ethical challenges and future directions in international student mobility for the future. Very important, not only in the debate in Norway about tuition fees for international students, but similar discussions in Denmark, in the Netherlands, a huge debate currently about international student mobility. And so it's important to have that discussion about what we are doing. So those are the two parts I start with. Next slide, please. Over the past half century, internationalization in and of higher education has evolved from being very marginal and ad hoc range of activities, student mobility for credits, student mobility for degrees, faculty mobility, transnational and cross-border delivery of education, internationalization of curriculum, etc., to a much more comprehensive and central process and policy for institutions of higher education, but also for national and local governments around the globe. We see now that many countries have either internationalization as part of their overall strategy for higher education or as a separate strategy. And even cities and states and provinces have that kind of approach. So it has become a key point on the agenda, and it's driven still by a very diverse range of rationales, political, economic, social, and cultural, by all kinds of different organizational and program strategies. And it includes the involvement of a broad range of stakeholders, internal students, deans, faculty, administrators, and external, like the local community, the government, etc., to the whole system. But at the same time, it has resulted in many different approaches and actions, which we use under the very broad umbrella term of internationalization of higher education. And next slide, please. So, but if we look back to the past decades, education abroad, which means all forms of mobility of students, staff, and programs, is more driving the agenda still than internationalization at home, which is internationalization of the curriculum, a campus environment, development of intercultural and international global competencies for all students in the home country, in the home institution. So mobility is still the driving synonym to internationalization of higher education. There's an increasing focus on international rankings, and the rules and favor of those rankings benefit others more than some. So it's only the driving of indicators by the rankings that define internationalization. That's the number of international students, the number of international faculty, and the number of co-authored publications internationally in peer-reviewed journals. We also notice that the divide between the North and the South, and between those universities classified as top world-class universities and the others, persist. So we still see, and I come back to that, internationalization as a Western paradigm. And we also see that it is very much driven by the agendas of a small number of institutions top in the rankings, where we have in the world around 25,000 or more institutions of higher education, which have a different context of internationalization of higher education, but has always been pushed by the pressure of the top. We also have seen that internationalization has become more synonym to competition and marketization than to its traditional values of cooperation, exchange, and service to society. So we see that we compete now much more than everything for in top talents, for in students, top talents in faculty, top access to ranking positions, top access to top journals for publication, for research, etc. Where originally the way we looked at internationalization, in at least in the European context, 30 to 40 years ago, was much more we cooperate, we exchange, and we serve to the society by doing that. We also have observed that inequality and exclusiveness increased both nationally and internationally, in part to this whole elitist approach to internationalization. Because if internationalization is mainly mobility, it's only for a very small percentage of the student population, for the faculty, and of institutions. Worldwide, less than 2% of the student population has an experience abroad, which means that 98% at least don't have that experience. We might be in Europe with the Erasmus program more successful to close to 20%, but that also means 80%. In the United States, it's something like 10%, and in the rest of the world, as I said, it's far less. So it is, in that sense, a very small elite of students, and the same applies to faculty and to institutions. And although we see that internationalization has become more and more on the agenda, we see that in most institutions, it's more lip service to the word internationalization and global engagement and other terms, where only a very small number of institutions of higher education really are internationalizing the internationalizing the higher education in a comprehensive way. Next slide, please. And it is certainly true that there has been a counter-reaction to this whole competitive environment that I described as over the past decades. There was already, around the turn of the century, the internationalization at home movement in Europe, which became broader around the world. At the same time, in Australia and in the United Kingdom, there was a strong movement for internationalization of the curriculum because they said, well, we recruit all those international students and we charge them high fees, but how valuable is that curriculum for those international students and how do we internationalize our own students? So that was another reaction that there is, and there is this whole notion of comprehensive internationalization in the United States. So at a certain moment in the past, well, 20 years ago, there were kind of similar reactions to this whole competitive environment and trying to focus on internationalization for all students. I come back to that, but it has not been very successful, but it is important to recognize that whole movement that has developed. We also see more recently attention to internationalization of research. Before that, it was assumed by higher education that research was international by nature, and so you didn't have to have a strategy for internationalization of research. But in this whole competitive environment that higher education globally is, also there is much more competition on the research level, and so you have to see, well, how can we respond to that? How can we react to that? And the same applies to the third mission of higher education, which is serve to society. You need to have a strategy for internationalization of higher education for society. So how can we, with our international activities, serve the global society in all its needs, like climate change, poverty, health, etc., etc.? So there has been a counter-reaction, that's for sure. Next slide. And in that, two dimensions are key as characteristic of what we mean with internationalization of higher education. It is very multifaceted. It includes the international education abroad, the internationalization at home, and all kinds of forms of types of mobility and of curriculum, etc. And it is an evolving process. Internationalization now is quite different than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and 40 years ago. Before that, even we didn't talk about internationalization of higher education. We talked about international education as a kind of fragmented list of activities. So multifaceted and evolving is very important. And you can say the same applies to study abroad, international students, internationalization at home, etc., etc. They are very multifaceted and they are an evolving process. So in summary, internationalization is not one model that fits all. Its diversity is institutional, local, national, and regionally defined and has changed and evolved over time in response to changing contexts and challenges. Because it's quite sure that if I take my own institution over the past years, Boston College, which is only a few miles from MIT and Harvard, internationalization means something completely different for those top world-class universities than for a national research institution like Boston College. Boston College is a Jesuit institution with a focus on internationalization, much on social justice. And by that, it is quite different than the competitive environment of MIT. And the same, I assume, is for Oslo Met in comparison to the University of Oslo, etc., etc. So there is not one model that fits all. It's all context related. Next slide, please. And that multifacetedness and evolution and adaption to historical and geographic context has been, to some extent, it's one of its main strengths, because it means that you always have to look into why is it important in your specific context and how can you develop a strategy for long term? What is the impact on the longer term, etc.? So that's useful. But at the same time, increasingly I see that together with its multifacetedness, it's a major obstacle, as the meaning of internationalization has been used by stakeholders in a diverse range of even meanings and policies, which are sometimes even conflicting. Let's take the example of international student mobility and why is it important for institutions and for governments. There might be a huge difference between a national policy and the way institutions look at it, or the way other stakeholders in higher education look at it. So it has become a little bit of a fake umbrella term. Next slide. And what we observe is a very problematic sloppiness on the meaning of internationalization. We mix and confuse why we are doing it, what we are doing, how we are organizing it, what should be the impact of internationalization, with whom are we collaborating, and where are we doing it. So it's context. All those terms are mixed and confused in a very complex way, and that's why we have lost a little bit the sense of what do we mean with internationalization of higher education. Next slide. It also is not only important in the context of when we talk about the broad term of internationalization, but we can also question the difference between internationalization at home and internationalization in the curriculum. People use those terms in a very easy way and don't be clear, is there a difference and should there be a difference between internationalization at home and internationalization of the curriculum? In the area of cross-border delivery of education, transnational education, there's also not a clarity what we mean with those terms. Is it only, as many think, about branch campuses, or is it also about mobility? Is it also about franchise operations and articulation programs? Very easily use of those kind of terms. Global citizenship and global engagement, very easily used by everybody as when we talk about internationalization of higher education. But the clear meaning, common meaning and understanding of what we want to say with those terms is lacking. That applies also to the use of intercultural, international and global. And as we discuss in the second part, it's certainly true in the area of international student mobility. And to a certain extent, this is understandable. And even I have to confess that I, in many cases, do the same, because it's so easy to use those terms, etc. But we have to be a little bit more aware about what we really want to say when we use those terms. Next slide. So if we look at the meaning of internationalization, quite commonly accepted was the definition first in 1993 and later updated in 2003 by my colleague and friend Jay Knight, as a, emphasizing that internationalization was a process. So the process approach was a very important step forward because it involved clarity that there was an ongoing process. It was not something that just was happening and then mission accomplished. It involved a whole range of internal and external stakeholders. And by that, it was a substantive difference from the previous context in which we used much more the word international education, which was reflecting that it was ad hoc and fragmented. So that definition made an enormous impact in our thinking about internationalization. Still much more from a practitioner point of view, because the work that Jay Knight and I did in the 1990s on the concept and strategy of internationalization of higher education for the OECD was based on our practical experience and not so much looked from a scholarly approach. Next slide, please. Still the definition by Jay Knight, also as a working definition, very clear, left ample room for different approaches to an understanding of internationalization, including much more competitive forms. So The shift from the term international education to internationalization of higher education has not created, in my view, more clarity about its meaning and focus, and reflected also an ongoing ad hoc and fragmented reality. And it brought about, and both Jay Knight and I and others have been writing about it, several misconceptions about what we mean in internationalization, in intended consequences and myths of internationalization, as Jay Knight herself wrote, and even Uwe Brandenburg and I in 2011 already say we should talk about the end of internationalization in the way we were using the word. So there has been a lot of discussion about it, but we still continue to be sloppy in our use of terms. Next slide, please. So in 2015, in response to all those uncertainties, we already had a discussion with in a Delphi exercise with scholars and practitioners around the world, what should be the defining internationalization for the future of higher education. And the clear response from all those people was it should be more inclusive and less elitist. Mobility in itself is an important part of internationalization of higher education, but it should not be seen as separate from the internationalized curriculum and the focus on internationalization for all. It should not be a goal in itself, but a means to enhance the quality of the three missions of higher education: education, research, and service to society. And it should certainly not focus solely on economic rationales. Next slide. So we updated the definition by Jay Knight as being not only a process, but an intentional process. So it doesn't go by itself. It has to be the intention of all the stakeholders to make that process happening. It has to be in order to enhance the quality of education and research for all students and staff, and to make a meaningful contribution to society. And in this way, we hope to move away from a much more working definition, which was leaving many things open. Next slide. And this in itself is a normative direction to the process. It is very distinctive from the more neutral and still usable working definition of Jay Knight, but it gives us a direction what internationalization should accomplish. And it fits into a whole range of other labels that have been used over the past decades to try to do the same. Comprehensive internationalization by John Hudzik, intelligent internationalization by Laura Rumley, ethical internationalization, conscientious internationalization, responsible internationalization, humanistic internationalization. They all try to make a normative direction to internationalization. And even learner-centered internationalization, forced internationalization focusing on refugees, coerced internationalization focusing on neocolonialism and decolonization processes. And you can say also that it is part of a term that you see much more used recently as an alternative to internationalization, which is the term global engagement. So there is this strong feeling that we should be more normative to a much more responsible and social responsibility in particular way of looking at internationalization. Next slide. And these appeals, they resonate pretty well if you look into discourses, webinars, even publications in journals and books, etc. But the reality, unfortunately, still is, and that brings us already close to the next part, that in practice, the focus continues, though, to be on internationalization abroad, the whole mobility side. So Larum and I speak of rhetoric more than concrete action, and with Betty Lisk and Elspeth Jones, I wrote about a struggle to move beyond good intentions and isolated examples of good practice. Of course, there is a new generation of scholars, for instance, Critical Internationalization Studies Network, which try to challenge the view of internationalization dominated by Anglo-Western perspectives and forms of knowledge. There are others like Elspeth Jones who say, well, we have to bring into the debate about internationalization all kinds of important things like equality, diversity, inclusion, social justice, decolonization, etc., etc. So there is a very clear common understanding for a change paradigm, but we are still far away from realization because it's much more rhetoric than concrete action. Next slide, please. And that is important in the changing global landscape because the competitive nature of internationalization, as we described over the past decade, there were a lot of people who said, well, the pandemic and the discourse about climate change needs, sustainability, etc., they all will change our view about internationalization of higher education and the role of higher education. But as we have seen more recently, that's unfortunately not happening. Geopolitical developments and tensions, the conflicts between China with the United States, Australia and Europe, the invasion of Russia and Ukraine, the whole debate about knowledge security and knowledge diplomacy, the increased still competition for global talent, the pandemic, climate, etc., nationalism, racism. There are a lot of challenges that make that normative direction to a much more socially responsible internationalization into a real big problem. So we have to ask ourselves, how will internationalization be changed in this global landscape? How will we challenge those problems, and how will they contribute to shape a real good future? That, I think, is one of the most important agendas for the future. Next slide, please. And if we look then to international student mobility, the main theme of your conference, that is as sloppy in use, in my view, as the word internationalization. Because there is not something like international student mobility. There are all kinds of different types of international students that move around the world. The three big differences are between degree-seeking students, credit-seeking students, and certificate-seeking international students. Degree-seeking are students who go for a bachelor, master, and or PhD from their home country to another country. Credit-seeking students take credits as part of their home degree abroad, for instance, in the Erasmus scheme. And certificate-seeking international students are those who are going for language courses, summer courses, not so much to get credits, but for extra competencies or skills that they otherwise would not have. Degree seeking is by far the most in the global context. Credit seeking, as I will describe later, is mainly in European and in American context. And certificate seeking students are probably as big as the degree seeking students in numbers, but we have very little concrete data about it. But the most important is we seem in our analysis not to distinguish between those three types. We also seem not to understand that they have different rationales, different experiences, and different outcomes. We also ignore in those three credits the levels of what international students study. If they are going for bachelor, master, or PhD, where they come from is different if they come from the global south or from the global north. How they are funding and the costs related to international students. What are their motivations? Why are they going to study abroad? A whole big difference of motivations that we can encounter. And there have been done some very interesting studies about that. But we don't seem to include in our analysis of international students those kind of dimensions. The same is true increasingly for the use of terms and meanings of virtual mobility, virtual exchange, and COIL. what is the difference between those three? And is it different than, for instance, MOOCs or distance education? We use very easily all those terms as well. And it is, of course, very important that increasingly that virtual dimension is becoming a very important part of the international student mobility scheme. Both within degree-seeking and credit-seeking and certificate-seeking international students. Certificate-seeking international students are basically related to distance education and to MOOCs. Credit-seeking international students are more focused on virtual exchange and COIL, and degree-seeking are also much more looking at distance education and could be called virtual mobility. So again, there's not one model that fits all international students, and that's very important to keep in mind. Next slide, please. So if we look at the two major components of international student mobility that we normally address, certainly in the European context, degree-seeking students and credit-seeking students. What are the major trends in degree-seeking students? Still the largest group, although we don't know exactly how many, because, I mean, not always the statistics even make a distinction between degree-seeking, certificate-seeking, and credit-seeking students. But let's assume approximately around 6 million, which is the double than 10 years ago, etc. So it's still an enormous move. It's mostly south-north mobility. But increasingly also it is south-south, and it is very limited in north-north mobility. We see increasingly a move from students not going to the north from the south, but staying in the south, going from Africa to Asia in particular, staying in Africa, staying in Asia, staying in Latin America. That's a very important trend that we have to see, to realize. Asia, with China and India leading by far, are currently dominant in sending. Africa is absolutely in numbers the future region in degree-seeking mobility. But if they go to Europe, if they go to North America, you can question. The very large majority will go to Asia or stay in Africa. Latin America is rather limited, to be quite honest, and mostly is within the region and at the postgraduate level. US, UK, Australia, Germany, and France are still the main host countries. China was, before the pandemic, starting to bite past them already. You can question if they can recover from that, but that's likely to happen as well, in particular because of the interest within Asia and in Africa. And there is a very strong call for more diversity of the host countries. So the host countries don't want to be dependent on only if more than 60% of their students being coming from China and India in particular, but it is very difficult to realize that. Cross-border delivery, so branch campuses, franchise, articulation twinning program, are perceived as an alternative option for the future. But are they really the case? We don't see a very strong increase in branch campuses. We see some increase in franchises and articulation and twinning programs, but we have not a clear idea how important they are. But the numbers are still very relatively small. The many challenges and the factors are increasing cost of living. I was reading yesterday a report that in the cost of living as a result of inflation, etc., is becoming for more than 50% of prospect international students the main challenge to go to study abroad. So that's a very important factor, and it also plays an important role, maybe even more than tuition fees in the Norwegian case. Lack of housing and other service, a main issue in many countries, in particular also a very important topic in my own country, the Netherlands. Language concerns, the dominance of English is an important topic that we have to face with, and a lot of discussion about it. The labor market needs, the stay rate. So the increasing shortage of labor in the host countries and the pressure to have them stay. Denmark, again, is a very clear example because they even say, well, we want to have only international students where there's a shortage on the Danish labor market. And as I will say later, you can have some ethical questions if the labor market in Denmark is more important than in the home countries of the students. Tuition fees, as I said, it's a big debate, as you know better than I, in Norway, but it has been a debate in the whole of Scandinavia and in the Netherlands. Is that in itself bad or is that good? How elitist is it if you have tuition fees for international students high that you cannot receive other students, but at the same time you can question if most of the students come from rich families, as has been also in a recent report addressed, why should the local taxpayer then pay for the elite? That's another point of discussion. Nationalism, racism plays an important challenge in the north. The quality of education, if you have international students with all kind of different qualifications and language skills, the increasing competition in the north and from the south is a challenge, and this call for more diversity of origin. So there are many challenges that we face. Still, there is this trend by national governments and by institutional leaders around the world in the global north to say, we want to recruit more international students and we want the revenue from those international students. I mean, there was, again, by Navitas, a report which said that most leaders of higher education institutions in the global north think that revenue of international students has to increase and has to be an important part of the higher education budget. So you can question then, what is this with respect to social responsibility? And in the UK, the only president of a university which opposed that kind of approach was a South African president of the London School of Economics, who said that it was unethical to do that. But the rest said, no, we think it's very important. So again, there's a lot of rhetoric, but the action is different. Next slide, please. Briefly on credit-seeking students, it's mainly North-North and mainly in Europe, Erasmus and from the United States to Europe, and then mainly undergraduate study abroad. It's even very limited in UK, Australia and Canada. In Western Europe, it's reaching its limits, in respect to the increase of numbers of Erasmus students and credit mobility. In Eastern Europe, it's still growing, but there is a challenge to find enough places. It's increasingly shorter in period, in particular in the United States, the data are very shocking. It's 2 to 6 weeks maximum, and very few students are staying a whole semester a year. It's mainly female and white. It's very limited in surface learning, so the whole it's only focused on study but not on learning. In practices, internships, etc. The language debate is also in credit mobility important. There's a lot of discussion about climate change in the Erasmus scheme, for instance, correctly so. Should we keep students going on EasyJet flying around Europe? But at the same time, as I must say, should we as administrators and leaders and faculty also be too much on the plane? And I apologize that I did that, and even not without many success. There's a lot of virtual exchange development taking place in a positive sense, but there are still a lot of imbalances in credit exchange. And there's a whole debate about educational tourism. Is study abroad as credit seeking really serving an academic purpose? So next slide, please. And so that was on the mobility side. We have to be much more clearer about what we mean when we are talking about international student mobility. And that is very important. And we have to ask ourselves the questions. So how can we realize a transformation internationalization for the future? We have to discuss who is engaged in internationalization, who is left out, what might be equitable and inclusive internationalization, what types of leaderships are needed in internationalization of higher education to achieve these goals. Should that be recruiters much more as an admission people, or should it be much more people who have a more comprehensive approach? How can internationalization be deployed as a tool of decolonization? How can we better prepare our graduates for future economic and social challenges? What deeper systematic changes are needed to make internationalization really getting to the core of higher education instead of being isolated to something in the international office and not focusing the main aspects of what we are doing? How can we make a meaningful contribution to society? How can we reimagine mobility and blended mobility models? How can we make a holistic approach, and what might be the digital transformation, etc., etc.? All kind of key questions that we have to constantly ask ourselves. Internationalization has become a key part, as I mentioned, of the agenda of higher education. Even if you look now at peer-reviewed journals and books and webinars and other activities, the main topic is internationalization of higher education in all journals. When I founded the Journal of Studies in International Education in 1997, I think it was, there was no journal that dealt with internationalization of higher education. Now it is the most used theme in academic journals around the world. So that has been in itself a very progressive development. But the way we do it is still very sloppy. And as your colleague Björn Sternacker and Jenny Lee from the United States have written, there is an under-theorized foundation of what we mean with internationalization of our education. So we still are in a very early process of really looking into what do we mean with internationalization of higher education. Next slide, and I'm coming to an end. In summary, internationalization as a process of higher education, as well as its diverse dimensions, requires more clarity on the meaning, the rationales, its program, and its organization, as well as outcomes and impact. We should accept and describe its multifacetedness and historical and geographical contextuality as an essential starting point for its understanding of what we mean. It doesn't help us to be sloppy in our use of terms, because then it becomes an obstacle instead of a solution. And it should be too easy to blame external factors and actors to the lack of socially responsible internationalization. We have to look ourselves, how can we be much more clear about what we mean, and what the context is and what we use those kind of terms. That's even more true than ever given the current geopolitical environment and for the topic of your conference, International Student Mobility. Let's be very clear about what we are talking about. Next slide. And that's more for discussion. All kind of ethical questions, not easy to answer, open for discussion, but also other topics, of course, if you have time. Are tuition fees, as your topic of discussion in Norway is, the real issue, or is more elitism and inequality? In other words, is it really a problem to have high tuition fees? No, but how are you using that money? Is that for budget cuts, as governments in general do? And I think the Norwegian government, if I understand well as well, or are you using that money to give scholarships and stimulate participation of students for underrepresented groups from abroad? That, I think, is much more helping to battle elitism and inequality. Is the role of English a problem or an opportunity? Is decreasing dependence on a small number of sending countries possible? Can we guarantee intercultural interaction outcome through mobility? We see still that most international students much more are interacting with other international students and the students from their home country than with local students? Is credit mobility good and degree mobility bad? Are labor market needs in the host countries more important than in the sending countries? I mentioned Denmark already. Are virtual exchange and online delivery the solution to for our ethical questions, like for instance climate change, or internationalization for all, which is much more easier by virtual? Is mobility elitist and for that reason always bad? And is the internationalization industry, agents, service providers, etc., an absolute need or questionable? These are all questions that we constantly have to ask ourselves, and I look forward, if we have time, for some question and answer and discussion. Thank you very much. I think that's the last slide as well, but besides, thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I think we will do one or two questions. So here is the rush to the floor. Anyone with a question? Yeah.
Thank you. Guri Vestad from the University of Oslo. You talk about the new models for international mobility, and I guess we are many here in the room today that are working intensively with establishing European universities alliances. You didn't mention that, but do you consider that as partly an answer to the needs in the future for international cooperation? We work with many different models for mobility, digitalization, and so on, so short-term, long-term, blended. So yeah, my question is, how do you look at that for the future solution, as a solution for the future mobility?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to really go into that, but now I have the opportunity. I must say that I, in principle, I'm in favor of the European University Alliances. My biggest fear is that it ends into a bureaucracy and paperwork and not a very strategic view from the European Commission, and also from many of the institutions as part, as much more seeing a kind of, we have to be part of it and we can maybe get some funding out of it, but not really having a vision of how it can be transformative. That is my main challenge. And we have seen in the past several attempts to make a big step forward in the European policies and programs, and some very successful, like the Bologna process, etc. But I don't see yet enough understanding by, in particular, the European Commission, that you can only accomplish this kind of alliances when you give it time to develop, and not always making new rules, new regulations, new opening for calls, etc., and when you don't invest substantive money together into this. If you do that, if you have a vision and a strategy, and if you have enough funding and you give it time, then I think indeed it has an opportunity to become successful. And I appreciate very much those alliances that do a lot of efforts, and I know that the University of Oslo is active in that part as well, and I'm confident that you try to do that. So don't see it as a critical to the institutions, but much more as how this initiative is in danger of falling into a bureaucratic process, much more funded by short-term work packages than by a vision for the future.
Thank you. We have to move on, but if there's a very short question, we can do that. Okay, I guess we will use the whole day to discuss this. Thank you so much for participating on the screen, Hans De Witt. We have a really nice box of chocolate here for you, but it's a little bit difficult, but I guess we'll find out how we do that. Thank you so much for participating.
Thank you, and I wish you all a good conference. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Mari Elkin. Elkin has recently started in a new job as associate professor at the University of Oslo after 10 years as a researcher at NIFU, but she's still associated with NIFU. Yeah, luckily. So Elkin's research interests are all connected to higher education, and they include governance, organizational changes, educational quality, as well as supranational educational politics. Lately, she has also been working on student mobility, and she has been leading one of the work packages within the mobility project, Changing Context of International Student Mobility. And today, she will talk about a characteristic of Norwegian policy on international student mobility.
Okay. Always nice to sit with these kind of microphones, make me feel like some sort of performer, which is very rare that we get to be, so this is always nice. First of all, a huge thank you for Hans David for kind of setting the stage for some of the things I'm going to talk about now. And perhaps some of the messages will also resonate with some of his points, especially concerning the, how to say, problematic sloppiness in how we talk about internationalization and student mobility in particular. As this is quite evident also in some of the debates in Norway. So what parts of mobility are in fact being discussed when we say student mobility? And what parts are actually rather taken for granted or not actually explicitly in focus. So what I'm going to focus here mostly is on international student mobility, with slightly broader, links or linkages to broader debates. And I also see the purpose of this presentation as providing some sort of broader canvas or a broader background for some of the other presentations coming later today, which go even more detailed into data, mobility patterns, who travels where, why, how, all of these kinds of more sort of, empirical sort of pattern-wise questions. And what I'm going to talk about is also not necessarily based on a single article. It's based on partially on literature that has, or studies that have been done before. It's partially based on a few different articles, which I've also co-authored with both people from NIFU, with Jannike and Elisabeth, Jannike Wees-Jansen and Elisabeth Hoved-Haggan, and also with some of my new colleagues now. So it is a bit of a mishmash of different things, trying to paint a large picture. And to say something, because this is kind of part of one of the work packages, as Jannike was indicating earlier. So this is part of the policy context study. And that has been quite an interesting process, to say the least. So when we start the mobility project, our focus was on thinking about the international student mobility and trying to understand, well, why is it so stable? There is such a focus on international student mobility, it's important, and it's so stable and nothing changes. And then we conducted our interviews and then pandemic hit. So we conducted the interviews sort of just at the beginning of the pandemic. Then we updated our interviews 2021, thought, okay, well, this was the thing. This happened. We're done with the pandemic, back to stability. And well done, tuition fees came. So suddenly our data, which we've been sort of collecting, talking to people, trying to make sense of why is there such a stability, and then everything changes. So it's also sort of what we are grappling now in some of the articles, sort of trying to finalize them, is grappling with the fact that most of our data is awfully outdated. But I'm actually using that as an opportunity also to show you what kind of change we're witnessing now and how dramatic it is and what kind of break it actually represents. So I'm going to talk about three things here. One is to give you a sort of a broad, rather descriptive timeline of international student mobility as a policy theme, and then to move a bit on the characteristics. So what did we find in our empirical analysis and how does that relate to the kinds of changes we see now? Not going to talk a lot about the mobility patterns, but it might be worthwhile for those who are those of you who are not sort of working every day crunching the numbers about student mobility, that Norway is not kind of it's not the top attracting country in the world, in the Western world, to put it maybe a bit diplomatically, but there has been a growth. The growth is not a major in the last few years. It's been quite stable, the share of sort of incoming or number of incoming students. And there's a lot of focus on sending Norwegian students abroad for various reasons. And of course, there is a distinction between what kind of policies and ambitions one has for full degree mobility, where we see different kinds of policy priorities. And then there is, of course, the notion of exchange. And in the area of exchange, up until the pandemic hit, there was quite a noticeable growth of student numbers as such. But the interesting part, of course, is that in terms of full degree students, Norway sends its students abroad into countries like UK, Denmark, Poland, US, Hungary, for various reasons you're going to hear about afterwards, the Netherlands. There's a lot of European countries, the US, Australia. So there's a kind of a cluster where you send students. But where do the students come from? There's a growing number of students from China. It's students from Iran, from Germany, from Sweden as well, and Pakistan and India. And these are the countries that have more than 500 students. So it's a rather different group where Norway sends or where Norwegian students go and where they come from as full degree students. That is a backdrop to some of the things I'm going to say now. Oh, please move. Oh, come on. Yes. Yes. Okay. So the origins and roots of international student mobility in Norway. And you can see quite different, how to say, patterns or trajectories. So when we talk about full degree mobility and outgoing mobility, until the 1970s, this primarily had to do with sending students abroad because these studies did not either exist in Norway or there was too few study places. So it was very much about capacity. So there's a really, really strong capacity focus. And in the 1950s, it was almost 30% of students studying abroad. So it was huge chunks sent abroad. And even though this kind of changed from the 1980s, the focus then was also turned into not just about capacity, but also about diversity. So we have different kinds of perspectives concerning these fields, which might be quite small or narrow in Norway. And this was quite an explicit policy intention. So there was also, it was explicitly sort of in the 1990s in policy documents, there's an explicit statement that, no, we're not going to expand medicine and psychology because that's not sustainable to have that many study places located in Norway. So the idea of sending, sort of having students move abroad to take their studies as a capacity issue and diversity issue was quite an explicit policy priority. So that's one part. So the outgoing students has its really its roots about sort of capacity, diversity, students going out as free movers, as sort of individually making the decisions, mostly because the studies maybe didn't exist at home. In terms of incoming students, and as a really important other pillar for Norwegian international student mobility, has to do with development help and developmental aid. And the first programs for that were already established in 1962. And after that, probably the most well-known recent program was the quota program, which was abolished in 2016. And that was really about providing students from the Global South with scholarship opportunities to come to study in Norway. And sort of having education as an important and integral part of development. So that's the other kind of sort of historical origin. But of course, things have changed. And what you're going to see then from the 90s and onwards is really a flurry of policy attention to international student mobility. And with regular intervals, there have been white papers that go explicit into student mobility, and also student mobility and internationalization being sort of a explicit stated aim in other major white papers on reforms. So already in 91, when you see the white paper for the college reform, the basis for the 94 college merger reform, there was a separate chapter on internationalization. So that was already explicitly present as a sort of, okay, internationalization is important for us. Also beyond mobility as such, we need to create connection points. We need to have good support to going abroad. This is important for us. It was about cultural competences. So many of the things we also hear about now were kind of stated already there. So it's there isn't this peculiar continuity in up until recently. In 96 was the first comprehensive white paper for international student mobility on study abroad. And that's where also sort of the explicit focus on having more focus on exchange students really was put on the agenda. And then the questions, of course, were how to shape student choice. The questions about scholarships, how do we fund, how do we sort of nudge students to taking the kinds of choices we want to for them to make. And that, of course, continued in quality reform. The focus was getting more into institutional responsibility, as with everything else in the quality reform, nudging more towards institutions becoming a bit more autonomous, a bit more sort of organized in terms of their activities for studies. But that was also when really the explicit focus on quality and internationalization as intertwined topics was really sort of consolidated. And that has been a continuous topic throughout since that quality reform era. And it's a peculiar combination, though. And I also heard that in Hans Tewitt's presentation. And you can hear the logic behind it. But there are some critical questions I'll get back to soon. But then 2009, an explicit white paper on internationalization of education, all education, not just higher ed. And here, really, the key, perhaps, development was this stronger emphasis on strategic thinking. So not all mobility is equal. Some mobility is better than other mobility. So there is a quality dimension introduced. And then again, new white paper on quality culture. Again, this quality continues. And then, well, 2020, new major white paper on internationalization or student mobility explicitly. Kind of business as usual, even though it was launched in the midst of the pandemic. It was supposed to be launched before, but then pandemic hit, and it was maybe not so easy to launch a white paper on student mobility 2 months into the pandemic. So it was slightly delayed, but it still came during the pandemic. The pandemic only is mentioned kind of in the foreword. The rest of it is business as usual. The new thing, perhaps, is the development of policy to attract students, so incoming students, which is one aspect which you could say, when Hans Tewitt was talking about exchange or degree granting, in Norwegian policy, the discussion also about outgoing incoming is something that has rather uneven attention. But here, the focus on incoming was becoming much more prominent. And of course, no tuition fees. And lo and behold, here comes autumn 2022, and no one, I have to admit, I did not see this coming. I don't know if anyone saw this coming. Given what we saw in the Hurdal Plattformen or the coalition agreement, there was a rather explicit statement about no tuition fees to become. It wasn't in the party program to any of the coalition partners. Yes, sure, there were other drastic changes going on in the sector. There is more concerns about funding, whether there is sufficient funding, you have to cut. So the cutting and the sort of consolidation sort of focus was perhaps there. But that tuition fee thing, I did not see coming. It was entirely unexpected. And it was very rapid, very rushed. And, well, now we have tuition fees. Well, probably, as is the status. Which says something about the introduction process. And I'll get back to that a bit later. But what to say about this development? So this was a very sort of broad brush. We've tried to go a bit more in detail into one of the papers. And what I was talking about also is something that Jannike has written much more about. So I'm trying to give a short version of her work, basically. But I think there's three things worthy to highlight here. One is that there is a very explicit and strong and active policy attention. The ministry in Norway has been quite elaborate and active and sort of promoting internationalization and student mobility. And also in the interviews we were conducting, when asked about, so who are the drivers for this? So who is pushing the agenda? And surely we were talking to policymakers, but also stakeholders in different parts of the sector. Ministry was often kind of mentioned explicitly. So there is an experience that there is a push from the ministry to make this happen. And this, of course, has results in expressions as well. International sort of student mobility has been part of the funding system. So there are sort of nudges where this is being pushed. The agenda is being pushed forward. And also the policy papers on this, all sorts of activities. So there is the establishment of CU in 2004 and its sort of subsequent subversions throughout many mergers. So there is an explicit sort of policy attention as well as infrastructure. And I think the case of CU here is an interesting one, given that it's being CU for a long time, having a strong position in internationalization debates, then becoming DQ, and then instantly becoming Hochoder, like a year afterwards. So the question also is, of course, their capacity is now, but that's maybe another paper. The other part, so there is a policy tension. That's quite clear. The other part, of course, which is super important when you talk about full degree students traveling abroad, is Lone Augustine. And I would assume most people would agree that for a student going abroad, the fact that they have a reasonably generous, and one might, of course, discuss this with inflation and so on, but internationally compared, it still is a reasonably generous scholarship from Lone Augustine and loan to go abroad. So the funding context is actually very favorable for students. And again, compared to what you might expect in the Norwegian context as a student, so on and so on, yes, you can debate whether that's good enough, but internationally compared, where in many cases you have no scholarship or no loan of a public source, that is quite a generous context. And Lone Augustine has been there for quite a while, and they've been a very important actor in here. And I'll get back to them a bit more as well. And then there's, of course, also Nordic and European exchange programs. So Nordplus, Erasmus, very, very important for the exchange aspect, as also Hans was pointing to. And surprisingly, sort of Nordplus is also still quite alive and kicking. Maybe not as visible as Erasmus occasionally, but it still has an important position in the Nordic context as well. Okay. So what I'm going to point to is three important characteristics. So that was the timeline. These are the milestones. Here are the shifts. Stability, stability, stability. That's the milestone story. And the three characteristics have to do with what I would then emphasize is actor involvement, the strong role of the ministry. The more sort of the development, which also Hans was pointing to, towards mobility becoming more strategic, more formalized, emphasis at the institutional level. And the third one, which is a bit sort of a tricky one, because it's always been this positive policy. It's a good thing. We want internationalization and mobility because it's a good thing. And there is occasionally very little critical debate on what that means. So if you remember the list from Hans as well, there are some more challenging aspects, some critical aspects about mobility, which we don't always talk explicitly about. And maybe we'll talk a bit. So as indicated, there is the sort of strong focus on the ministry as being one of the sort of drivers. And that also is expressed sort of the other way around, is that when ministry develops policy for higher education, internationalization and student mobility is often somewhere. So you often have a chapter on something international when a new white paper comes for any topic, basically, on higher ed. So there is this understanding that internationalization and student mobility is an important thing. So we include it in our debates. So it has a sort of this positive connotation as such. And of course, the role of institutions and students is also important, is in particular that students, well, if they're full degree students, they kind of decide if they want to go abroad or not. They have agency here. And of course, from the institutional side and also academic staff, there is a bottom-upness, of course. That's where the academic logic comes in. So they are, of course, also sort of engaged in this notion of international cooperation, about mobility, creating the sort of basis for bilateral agreements which can also facilitate mobility. It's there, of course. But that's not the same kind of sort of policy attention that is really coming. That's much more sort of happens here and there, slightly fragmented, less coordinated as such. So there is kind of a top-down and bottom-up dynamic at play. And this... This, when I was making the slides, I thought this was wonderful. The slide probably should say until autumn 2022. It was so prominent in all of the interviews we did, that there is so strong consensus orientation. And the two quotes up there are just fantastic examples of that. One being that there is no point in contributing to a policy that nobody wants, because then you divert attention from other important political issues. So that, I think, sums up a lot about Norwegian higher education policy until recently. that there is an idea that we have to agree on issues, because if we start sort of spending time on arguing, then not much gets done anyway. Then there is opposition, and then there is political contestations and pushbacks in all kinds of directions. So the important part is sort of trying to find a consensus that we can work with and then get it done. And the idea was that international student mobility is important. We want to do this, and we all agree on this. And in terms of different white papers and policy initiatives, there's always sort of also work to achieve a consensus before a white paper comes. So the idea is that when the white paper comes, by that time, no surprises. By that time, you should know what's coming. Everyone should know what's coming in broad terms. So you don't want sort of the moment of, oh, wow, what shall we do now? So there are consultations. There is a consultation, there is an engagement of the sector, there are feedback runs, there are hearings. So it's not sort of the ministry being completely closed and then coming with a proposal and then, ta-da, you have to implement it with no information. So there is an interaction going on and feedback and consultations. So that has been really sort of a characteristic of how policy has been made earlier. And then turning back to fees. So one, you can discuss it in terms of the breaking content, that we have always said that there wouldn't be fees and now there are fees. Sure, that's a break. And that's a change. But I would also argue that, well, discussing whether there should be fees, it's a legitimate political discussion. And it has been there also a few rounds before. 2014, 17, I mean, FFB and Høyre have been pushing for it for a while. And that it's a legitimate political discussion to be had. Who should pay? What do we want? How should we spend this money? And as a political discussion, it's okay to have that. The problem here was, so the discussion here is more about how also the policy was introduced. And I'm sort of making a case for student fees here. It's more the fact that you have different opinions in the political spectrum about this, and that you might discuss it and then land on one or the other, that's how politics works. What happened here now was that it was also a different mode of making the policy. There was no consultation proper. There is no sort of consensus orientation. So very much about also a break from how you made policy, not just what policy it was. And there is kind of this lack of risk assessment. So you have all this sort of, oh, shit, our study programs are going to be closed because da-da-da-da-da. So these kinds of assessments were not done. And now it's kind of, we're doing this and we're doing this year. And in contrast to many of the other Nordic countries, they also introduced fees. And it's, you can agree or disagree on that being a good thing in terms of all sorts of issues. Sure. But at least there was a development time. You introduced scholarships maybe at the same time. You were thinking through how this should be introduced. What are the impacts going to be? And maybe Sweden didn't realize it would be 80% drop, but still there was a bit more time than introducing the fees after students had applied. So there is the problematic aspect of how, which is quite visible. Yeah. Two? Didn't I have half an hour? Oh yeah, okay, yes. Positive policy. So relations to equality is usually the expressed argumentation. But there are various rationales at play. And the questions about is quality the input or the output? What are you trying to achieve? And how really does internationalization contribute to quality? What kind of quality is that? We know quality is a very messy and sloppy concept, a very unclear concept. So when we say internationalization and quality, what kind of quality? Whose quality? And that's quite unclear in most of the debates. But gaps. This is perhaps the point I want to get to most, is when we talk about student mobility, the critical parts are not that discussed. So the question is, it would be a fair question to ask, is all outward mobility desirable? Should all get equal degree funding? Or should the funding to take a degree abroad? I mean, if I was a student representative, I would say, yes, of course. But from a sort of public economics perspective, you could say, we should discuss this. There are legitimate arguments to say this is a priority for us, this is not. But that's never discussed. The other part could be about more fundamental changes rather than adjustments in Lånekassen. So how do you give out student support to travel abroad? could one think more differentiated? Could one think about entirely different? Because until now, Lonnekasten's support has been tweaked. But it's tricky to change that fundamentally, because that's a non-touchable issue. How do you treat the notion that in foreign policy and educational policy you have rather different priorities? And what does that mean in how you administer programs? And the big sort of elephant in the room in many of the interviews was skilled migration. So what do you do to attract students, and do you want them to stay? And the answer usually was, we don't know. And it's been politically challenging to discuss that. There is largely no attention to it in the policy debates. If you compare to Denmark, in Denmark, that's the driving policy issue for 20 years, is we want them to stay, and if they're not staying enough, then we cut it. So it's really explicit. We want to attract students in. And what we see here now, especially in the tuition fee debates, is this is absent, that debate. Even though you get the statements, we run out of money before we run out of people, but strangely, no link. There is a more strategic and formalized cooperation. I talked about that. And there is an expectation that this should also contribute to the institutions. So it's not just about sort of making it nice for the student, but if you talk about exchange and sort of bilateral agreements, there should be something more for mobility. But there are all sorts of new challenges. So security, how do we tackle that really in practice when we talk about student mobility? There is a panorama strategy, which explicitly includes quite a good number of the countries which are maybe a bit tricky to cooperate with these days. So there is a quite a strong inconsistency here. So how do we deal with security issues when our priority is to work with countries we are a bit wary about? So how do we manage that? How do we actually tackle north-south sort of imbalances? Do we want skilled migration? Are we really advocating for brain drain? How do we sort of tackle the fact that the street is sadly still quite one way in many instances? Yes, there is more south-south cooperation as well, but there is an imbalance in the world. How do we tackle that, actually? Sustainability. Yes, we can say that. I think in the interviews, the comment when I was asking about this was really that, well, it's your weekend trip to New York, you should cut, but you should still do student mobility. Yeah, sure. Would that mean that we should actually focus on student mobility in a place where we can go by train? Why not? I mean, we should discuss that, seriously. What is the impact of the pandemic and changing habits of students and staff in traveling? Some of it is probably going to be also maybe have some kind of permanent effect. And then really, how do we mitigate the negative consequences of tuition fees? These are really, really difficult questions. And I haven't really seen a good public critical policy-related debate on these issues. And that is really the core issue here, is when we talk about sort of this competition and collaboration, yes, some countries compete for getting international students and fees. We should do more collaboration, and cooperation is a good thing. Sure, I agree. But even if you look within Europe or the EHA, you have countries which have a very authoritarian pathway now, where academic freedom is being constrained, or on a sloppy side, or sort of slope side down. There are issues within Europe. There are issues within the Bologna process. So when we talk about collaboration, how do we balance the notion that we do want to collaborate for economic reasons? There are important sort of rationales for that. And that then entails having strategic partnerships with very, very, very tricky regimes. How do we manage that? I mean, and I think not so much about student mobility, but research cooperation, the discussions about the centers driven by China in Norwegian universities has been quite interesting in that. That suddenly pops up, ooh, we have to talk about this. And then, final thing. So I'm getting there. Just to sum it up. It's always sort of internationalization policy, even though it's everywhere. It's still quite isolated. And there are these discussions about foreign affairs. There are discussions about quality, what that really means for educational quality. They are not connected enough. So internationalization is kind of, we need more internationalization. But what does that entail? How do you connect the dots? That's not really been always as visible. And this uncertainty actually has been there both before the tuition fees and also after. So that there isn't a clear direction. What is it that we want with international student mobility? Aside saying, well, it's good for personal growth, it's good for Norway, cultural skills, da-da-da-da-da. But what do we really want? How do we tackle those critical issues? Where do these come in? How do we just ignore that they exist? And then, of course, there are these disparities in terms of policy attention. Focus on exchange versus full degree, and especially the sort of rather glaring lack of focus on incoming students until recently. So there is much more talk about outgoing. Incoming is a bit more, they come because we have so high quality. And then final, and this is perhaps a word of caution or a word of background for all the rest of the day. And what the tuition fees setting has taught us is that the fact that something is taken for granted, the fact that we take for granted that focus on mobility is there always, does not mean resilience. So the fact that it always has been does not mean that it's always going to be there. And when windows of opportunities emerge, political or policy related, radical change can happen very, very radically or very, very fast. And so there is a need to maintain explicitly practices we want to keep. So when we want to do certain things in higher education sector, we have to work with them explicitly. We cannot assume that they will exist always in the future. We don't put attention to that. And it really also requires careful thought. What do we mean? We have to put content into our discussions about mobility and internationalization. What is it? Who is it? What are the desired outcomes of this? And how do we do that? And not just sort of then talk about it maybe in your office, maybe with your office mate, but take that up into the public debate. So what kind of mobility, for whom, and for what? Thank you. That was it.
Thank you so much, Mari. I think you really managed to set the scene together with Hans De Witt. A bunch of questions. It would be really nice, of course, if you had the opportunity to ask questions now, but I also respect the break.